call. Yeah.
Good morning, everyone. We're going to go ahead and call the Senate Committee on Judiciary to order. I want to thank everyone for being here. Today, we have a number of bills that are scheduled for either possible work session, hearing and work session, or just work session. We do have some notes. Let's see. Let me just start at the very bottom just to give notice on the work session for Senate Bill 1571. We're not sure we're going to be able to work that bill today because we're waiting for an amendment that's supposed to be coming in. So if we get the amendment and we have everything we need, we may be able to work it today. But I'm just going to say more than likely it will be tomorrow is the way we think it's going to be. We are going to start at the top of the agenda and go down. And I do want to just give the notice on the first bill, Senate Bill 1553. We will have a public hearing. We will not be able to actually do the work session on that bill because there is another amendment, I believe, that we're missing or we need. Paperwork, excuse me. So the paperwork may come in. So for all of the bills that we have on our agenda today, it's going to be wait and see as we work through today to see if we can actually move bills. The goal of the chair and the committee is to move as many of the bills forward as we can today and lighten the load and have things done hopefully by tomorrow and not have to worry about coming back on Thursday unless there's just absolute paperwork that we can't get around or we don't use a procedural rule to take care of that. As the vice chair and I have already had, let's say, discussed.
Yes.
So with that, I'm going to go ahead and open up our public hearing on Senate Bill 1553. This is a bill that we've already started taking public testimony. And what we've done, and you can see on the agenda, that we asked for those who were not able to be heard yesterday during the hearing that had signed up to come back today if it was possible so they can get their statements onto the record. So with that, let's see, is that Chanis?
Yeah,
why don't you give us a brief...
Oh. Chair Przanski, members of the committee, Senate Bill 1553, as you may recall, deals with an unlimited statute of limitations for first-degree sex crimes. And as well has an addition to the Assault 3 statute when a person causes physical injury to another by means of a motor vehicle with criminal negligence. We have several amendments before you today. The proposed -1 amendments add an existing public records exemption and prohibit the disclosure of images of death as part of a law enforcement investigation. If release of those images would constitute an unreasonable invasion of privacy of a deceased person's family, the proposed -2 amendments limit the Assault 3 provisions to only those who are vulnerable road users. The proposed -5 amendments clarify that any misdemeanor, Class C felony, or felony punishable as a misdemeanor is eligible for set-aside. This is a cleanup of a bill we did in the 2015 session. And then you have the proposed -8 amendments, which are a combination of the -4s, -6s, and -7s, which clean up the language around the statute of limitations.
All right, thank you. So I have four individuals that are signed up to continue over from yesterday. And I think what I'm going to go ahead and do is, since we've already heard from proponents, I'm going to go ahead and let the opponents come forward, and then we'll finish up with the proponent having the last word, and we can have some discussion on next steps. So with that, let's go ahead and ask Gilmeyer, Eric, and Ken Nolley. Why don't you all three please come up?
Thank you. Chair Przanski, members of the committee, thank you. It's Gail Meyer on behalf of the Oregon Criminal Defense Lawyers Association. I'll be addressing my remarks to Section 1 of the bill, which addresses the statute of limitations. My colleague Eric Dietrich will be addressing the committee on Section 2, which creates the new crime of criminal negligent assault. With respect to the extension of the limitation period, I've given this testimony before and we've had this conversation before, so to some extent this committee already knows what it is I'm going to say. We have posted materials up on OLIS, and I yesterday handed out something in writing. There is a list here of tangible objects that are present out there in the world that right now can get these allegations in a position where the district attorney chooses to dismiss these charges. They choose not to prosecute or go forward with them. Or if they do go forward, that they actually result in acquittals at trial. These are items that really help refute or corroborate what the heck happened between two people when there's a dispute as to whether or not something was consensual, whether anything happened at all, or whether or not it wasn't in fact hostile. Cases have been dismissed by and through business records, security videos, cell phone records. These things have a short shelf life. Hotels can be shut down after 25 years. You're not going to know who the check-in clerk was. Security videos go away. They're looped over. And so the further you extend out the limitation period, the more likely it is that these artifacts, these tangible objects, won't be available in the event that a dispute rises way down the road. Second to that, too, on the other side of the handout that I gave you, is a chart comparing the due process rights that are afforded in the neighboring states to Oregon and how Oregon differs from that. And it isn't just with respect to access to a witness's testimony in the grand jury or through a deposition, but that's very big, that's huge. It's also the prevalence of a unanimous jury verdict in 48 states and in the federal government, and Oregon being an outlier, along with Louisiana, tolerating a 10-2 jury verdict. I appreciate, Senator Thatcher, your queries to that. The response you received was they thought that it was a red herring. And what I can tell this committee is it most definitely is not a red herring. About 5 years ago at the Office of Public Defense Services, they did just a random audit. They just took all the – this is the appellate pipeline now on the defender's side. They just took a freeze frame of all the cases in their offices, and they went in there and they dived backwards into the court system to find out whether or not it was a unanimous or a non-unanimous jury verdict. Now, this was all kinds of charges. So this included burglaries, identity theft, everything else. Two-thirds, over 60%, were non-unanimous jury verdicts. Anecdotally, what we can say is that practitioners report to us that in sex crimes, they're almost always 10-2 jury verdicts. So what we have here in Oregon is an instance where two people can be racked with reasonable doubt as to what occurred and very much doubting the legitimacy of a conviction. And yet it's a lawful verdict in Oregon when it's not in 48 other states. So we're OCDLA, the practitioners who try these cases in the courtroom, are distressed to see, once again, a willingness to extend a limitation period without redressing these procedural limitations that we have here in this state. If the grand jury bill were to pass, we would at least be mildly mollified, but we're quite distressed to see these two bills proceeding on parallel tracks and not at all tethered. With respect to two other comments about the bill specifically, number one, I want to point out to the committee, it includes the crime of sex abuse in the first degree. Now, admittedly, the other three crimes, rape, sodomy one, unlawful sex penetration in the first degree, those really are the worst of the worst. They engage, those involve penetration. Sex abuse in the first degree is a broad continuum of conduct, but it can include conduct as limited as the nibbling on an earlobe or stroking down someone's cheek. And it occurs in this way. The definition of sex abuse, one, is sexual contact, which includes touching, of an intimate part for the purpose of sexual gratification and arousal. The Court of Appeals has said intimate part is not defined by the legislature as genitalia or the breast, so it could be any intimate part, and it's allowed to be in the subjective assessment of the recipient. So if the recipient says, I considered my earlobe an intimate part and I did not consent to have someone nibbling on it, I considered my cheek an intimate part and my neck an intimate part, and I don't consent to someone stroking it, those have resulted in convictions and have been sustained. It is a mandatory minimum sentence. It is a 75-month sentence. But my point to the committee is, whatever legitimacy may or may not be present with respect to putting the worst of the worst, rape one, sodomy one, unlawful sex ban one, with an extended limitation period, I think a separate conversation is deserved with including that crime of sex abuse in the first degree. Lastly, I'd like to address my comments to the Dash 8 Amendment. And I'm sorry, I should have opened these remarks. I want to thank the chair for hosting the work groups that we had over the summer. I know it was a very difficult conversation in 2015. I appreciated the discussions. It was one of those, they were great discussions, and I thought that they were very courteous and respectful position to position. And I do think with respect to the amendments, most of the amendments are very much improvements. With respect to the Dash 8, if I could, I'd like to direct the committee's attention to line 16. What this does is that it seeks to amend and limit something that is in the bill that we want to see in the bill. So in the bill itself, on page 3, it adds something that we would call, the practitioners would call, a Brady requirement. It would be a requirement for the prosecuting attorney commencing a prosecution with an extended limitation period here. The bill reads, shall present any evidence reasonably tending to negate the guilt of the defendant to the grand jury considering the indictment for the offense. The discussion in the work group was, look, if in the course of prosecuting someone with an extended limitation period, if in the course of investigating the case, the government were to find evidence that's inconsistent with the allegation, that's helpful to the defense, even if it's inconsistent statements for the purposes of impeachment, present that to the grand jury. Admittedly, there's a constitutional and ethical obligation of the prosecution to do that at the trial itself. It's called Brady versus Maryland. We call it the Brady duty. They have the duty to be forthcoming and give this stuff over at the trial phase. So the argument in the work group was, well, then do it at the front end, do it in the grand jury. What the Dash 8 does, though, is it further limits it to only that evidence which is known to the prosecuting attorney. And this undercuts the entire basis for the Brady rule at its inception.
So let me just ask real quick, do you think this somehow takes the obligation of Brady out of the equation?
Chair Pozanski, yes, because Brady isn't limited to evidence that's known to the prosecution. It includes evidence that is known to law enforcement in the course of gathering the case. What happens when you limit it to only evidence that's known to the prosecuting attorney, you institute a tolerance and an incentive to do hear no evil, see no evil. Don't tell me nothing, then I don't know it, and then I don't have to present it. And the Brady obligation was all about opening up that gateway from what the law enforcement knows, upload everything you know to the district attorney so the district attorney can implement their constitutional and ethical duties at trial. Now, I want to say to this committee, it's a given that the Brady versus Maryland obligation does not apply to the grand jury. They are not constitutionally obligated to present this evidence at the grand jury. They're only constitutionally obligated to present it at the trial. The argument in the work group was, well, if you're going to use this extended limitation, then for Pete's sake, help the grand jury out at the front end and let them know what the inconsistent evidence is. But to allow it to be limited to only evidence known to the prosecutor, you incentivize law enforcement to not communicate. And that's not what the Brady obligation sought to do. They sought to have a continuum and open dialogue so that law enforcement understood, we have to let the entirety of everything we know be known to the prosecution so the prosecution can go forward and implement this. So, in conclusion, with respect to the Dash 8, we think the Dash 8 is an improvement. We would ask, however, that line 16 not be included in the final amendment.
Eric, are you going next, or Gail, are you still going?
Mr. Chair and members of the committee, my name is Ken Nolley. I'm a resident of Salem. I'm a retired college professor, and I work with Oregon Voices. It's, as some of you may know, a group of families of people impacted by the sex offender registry. I've been doing that work since 2009. I never look forward to coming to testify here, which I've done more and more. It's not fun to come and testify on these issues from the point of view I have to represent. I have particularly dreaded today. I dreaded it all the more after yesterday. I sat and heard the testimony of rape victims yesterday that you heard. And I heard them with the same ears you have. But I heard as they talked the voice of a daughter of a friend, the voice of the daughter of a friend of my wife, the voice of my niece. I take all of those things really, really seriously. And I dreaded coming here to take a position that seemed to oppose voices that I care about so much. In 2009, before 2009, I would have been here yesterday to speak for the bill eagerly. But my life changed in 2009 in ways that I couldn't have imagined. In 2009, our son was arrested for a sex offense. He did it, and although we felt in many ways the system overreacted, it was his fault that he got into it. But in the fall of 2009, we met a group of other people and founded Oregon Voices. At that first meeting in December of 2009, I heard a story that I want to tell you today. And I want to tell you it because it was the beginning of that journey. I didn't look forward to that first meeting. I thought I'm going to meet sex offenders when I go there, and I felt uncomfortable about that. I don't know why I did, because I had a son who was one, and I knew that at that point. What I wasn't prepared to meet was people there who said they were innocent and had been falsely accused of this. Now, in some ways, perhaps that sounds a little naive, but I want to say I'm not a naive person. I taught for 47 years, and I never accused a student of plagiarism who didn't deny it, even when I knew where every word in that paper came from. I taught at the prison for a year inside the walls, and I read papers from prisoners that I didn't often believe. My wife did protective service with CSD for years and worked with the hardest cases and dealt with decisions about termination of parental rights. We're not naive people. We've been lied to, and we have a long nose for that sort of thing. This story was really compelling, and it went sort of like this. I should pause here and say I gave you a brief account of it in the letter I wrote, and I have to apologize and say I got two things wrong in that account. I talked to the person last night on the phone for an hour and heard the story again in detail, and two figures in that were wrong, but they had crept into the telling that my wife and I have used of the story over the years, and I think they illustrate graphically the way that memories are not trustable over time, even when people mean the best, have the best interest in mind. This story that we met that day, a young man who had just come out of prison after over 6 years. He had come up to Oregon from California. He'd been an attorney. He had come there because of a grave illness in his sister's family. His sister-in-law was bitterly angry at his wife at the time because she had not taken the time off or couldn't get the time off from work to come up herself. And she said at the time to her sister, "I'm going to get you for this." Whether that had anything to do with what follows, I have no idea. I don't know that any of us could make that judgment. But during the visit, he was left alone at the house briefly with the niece, who with his niece, who was the real ill person at the time and a friend of hers. Later, that friend charged that he had touched her inappropriately in the kitchen. When that led to charges, he was shocked by the process. He had been an attorney in California, and he couldn't believe the way in which the process here closed off rights that he considered basic. The first trial ended in a 9-3 verdict for acquittal, not 10-2, as I said in the letter I wrote on Sunday night. DA decided to take it back. The first case had involved two charges. The DA went back, spent a period of time in the black hole of the grand jury, came back with four charges, each time offering a sweet plea deal if he would just take a plea. But this young man said, I cannot, will not plead guilty to something I didn't do. The second time, new evidence that was not shared came out, and he was eventually convicted on 11-1 verdict, with one holdout who strongly still was convinced that he was innocent. Since that time, I don't know how many people I know who have heard that story and know about the story who are convinced, as I am, that this man is innocent. Since that time, I've heard story after story after story. Usually, in fact, almost all the time, they're sex abuse charges. Almost always, those charges rest on a single person's account. And over again, I hear families shocked, horrified, and who assert the innocence of the person, and the person asserts their innocence. My wife and I get these stories now. People call and say, what can you do? We don't have anything we can do. But we almost know the lines now. We can jump ahead of them and say, and this is what happened. They're hit with these charges. They're told there'll be a plea deal if they want. They hire an attorney. The defense attorney asks for $20,000 straight up front. Then they don't hear from that attorney again for a while until that attorney comes back and says, take the plea deal. I can't speak to the ways in which the non-unanimous verdict may affect most of those cases, because large numbers of them say we can't take the extra time that we're going to get, and they take the plea deal. But I can't tell you how many times I've heard this story credibly from people who say, this is not what I thought America was. And I'm here to say that this is not what I thought America was. I think we can do something better here. We need to do something for those rape victims. But I have meeting a lot of people, some of whom I'm sure are telling the truth, who are also innocent victims, and their lives and the lives of their families are being destroyed. The man I'm talking about was an attorney. His marriage broke up. He was disbarred. He was forced to stay in Oregon. He has since married. His wife is Chinese. He has two lovely children. He is an extraordinary man. His wife may be deported because may not get her citizenship, may have to go back to China because he is a sex offender. The punishments go on and on and on. There are a lot of victims here, but they're not simply the rape victims. If we really want to fix these problems, we should take this bill back, and we should convene a group that involves victims of wrongful accusations. We should have rape victims. We should have prosecuting attorneys. We should have defense attorneys. We should have judges who know how these patterns are working. But right now, there are grave injustices taking place, especially with sex abuse one. And I beg you to try to address that when you address this. Thank you.
Mr. Chair.
You want to ask now?
I just had a comment.
Okay.
I think we do have a process for sorting out false accusations that's called the criminal process with a jury. And it's hard for me to stomach the idea that sex offenders who are convicted of sexually abusing someone are the victims in a crime. I worry about statements on the record that suggest that those who have experienced a rape because it happens in a private place are lying. I just think it contributes to that culture that makes it incredibly difficult to get a rape conviction, to have victims of rape step forward when they're fearful that in public places people will say that they are lying and destroying the lives of those that have destroyed their own lives. So I just take exception to some of what has been stated because of the way that contributes to the culture that makes it very difficult for victims of sexual violence to have the courage to come forward, say what has happened to them, often in a private place that has destroyed their lives. They are the victims, not the ones that violated them. And I believe we all have a right to say that nobody gets to nibble on my ear or stroke my face. My body is mine. It doesn't matter what part of my body is violated. All of my body belongs to me.
May I respond?
Briefly.
I will be brief. Senator Gelser, members of the committee, before I started this process, I would have said exactly what you said. I had colleagues who would say, if a woman says she's been raped, she's been raped. I'm not even talking about rape allegations here. Principally, I don't know of any of those charges where I'm bothered by the stories I've heard. And I do not want to impugn wrongfully any victims. That's part of why, as I said at the beginning, I dreaded coming here today. But I believe with every fiber of my being that some of these people are telling the truth. I met once after when we were working on.
I need you to wind up. I appreciate you have another example to give to us, but the bottom line is I've got another person on this, and I've got another person after that, and I've got two more hearings.
I apologize. I'll stop. Thank you.
All right. Thank you, Eric.
Chair Brzezinski, Vice Chair Cruz, members of the committee. My name is Eric Dietrich. I'm here on behalf of the OCDLA to address our concerns with Section 2 of the bill. I'm very well aware of the fact that this is different than Section 1 of the bill, and the tone and tenor of my conversations will be different, and I'm respectful of the way the conversation of Section 1 is different than Section 2, and so that's not out of disrespect to those who were just here at the same time, because it's the same bill. I want to address, I think there's four issues that kind of highlight our primary concern with Section 2, which makes it a felony if, with criminal negligence as a result of a motor vehicle accident, you cause serious physical injury to a vulnerable road user. And the first piece I'd highlight for this committee is the felony piece. We know, according to FBI statistics, that since 1993, violent crime has gone down nationally significantly, almost in half. And we also know that at that same time, the number of felony cases going through our criminal courts has increased. And so what we conclude from this is what we call felony creep or felonization, or just a general increase in the type of behavior we as a society deem to be felonious behavior. And that kind of highlights one angle of our concern. The second piece is the criminal negligence piece. The Oregon Supreme Court issued an opinion last week in a case called State v. Siminoff, and it was an opinion about whether you can commit the crime of unlawful use of a motor vehicle with criminal negligence. What's car theft? Can you commit car theft with criminal negligence? And the Supreme Court said, no, you can't, and that's not important for this conversation. But what it did do, because they don't review terribly many of these cases, was they went through a legislative history of how these mental states came into our criminal code. And, you know, the four primary mental states that were adopted by the legislature in 1971 are those who act intentionally. That's the top one, those who intend a specific result. Below that is folks who act knowingly. They are not necessarily trying to intend a certain result, but they're aware of their behavior at the time they're engaging in it. Below that piece is those who act with a reckless mental state, and that would be, I guess, the William Tell example, when you have a crossbow, someone's standing there with the apple on their head. You're not trying to aim the crossbow at the person. You're, I guess, trying to hit the apple. But obviously, when you're engaging that behavior, and it's kind of an absurd example, but it highlights the issue. When you engage in behavior like that, you know it's risky. You're aware of, at that moment, that you are engaged in risky behavior. And then below that is the criminal negligence standard. What the Supreme Court talked about in Siminoff is, when the legislature met from 67 to 71, in the original draft of the criminal code, criminal negligence was not included. As the discussion evolved, it was included, and it is a tool in our criminal code, but the Supreme Court in Siminoff said it was to be an exceptional tool. This should be applied in exceptional cases. And so that's the second piece that highlights our concern. The third piece would be just the general consequences of a felony conviction. We know that a felony conviction has impacts on housing, employment. We know it has impact on basic privileges we all take for granted, like driving, possessing weapons. But we also know it carries a huge stigma culturally. If people know you're a felon, they look at you in a different way. So that's the third piece. And then the fourth piece would be the velocity in which these events will occur. You know, you can imagine negligence cases where, you know, there's hazardous products introduced into the consumers, where there's workplace safety issues or toxic torts that occur over a long period of time. The negligence in these types of cases that will be authorized by this proposed piece of legislation are going to happen in a split second. And so taking those four concerns together, we see a trend that maybe, from our perspective, the pendulum has swung too far in what we deem to be felonious behavior, that even though this criminal negligence tool is on the books, it should be an exceptional tool, and that in very split-second, fast-moving moments of time, people will engage in behavior that they're not even necessarily aware is risky at the time that will have long impact on their lives going forward. That's the primary concern we have with this piece of legislation. There are other secondary concerns. One thing we wanted to highlight for this committee as you consider this is in a typical negligent civil suit where there is a dispute about who is at fault, the parties to the lawsuit and the jury can consider the contributory negligence of each actor at the moment at which the event occurred. That's not true in criminal law. There is a Oregon Supreme Court case from 1978 called State v. Simmons, which clarifies that contributory negligence is inapplicable in criminal law. So the jury in these types of cases would not be able to consider the contributory negligence of the other party to the accident. And I guess finally what we'd like to highlight is I know this committee is very concerned with public safety. That's a primary task of this committee. In terms of legal theory, one of the reasons we have laws that prohibit things is the hope that it will keep people safe by deterrence. And what the Supreme Court said in Siminoff is that generally criminal negligence doesn't provide deterrence, because to be deterred, you have to be aware of the law and you have to be aware of what you're doing is wrong at that moment. And because this is a negligent standard, in those moments of time, people aren't necessarily aware. They're not thinking. And I think that's the final concern we have with this bill. Thank you for letting me speak to this committee. I'm happy to answer any questions.
All right, thank you. Questions for anyone on the panel? All right, I've got a couple of things. First of all, Gail, a question came up regarding your example of the person who got convicted of, stroking or nibbling on someone's ear. You said that was a conviction? That resulted in a conviction?
Chair Brzezinski, yes.
And what was the sentence that was a mandatory minimum sentence?
Yes.
Of 75 months, 60
yes,
months?
75.
Regarding the issue, Eric, on the criminal negligence, as you can, I guess, how did you distinguish between criminal negligence homicide and this bill here? Because from what I've heard that has come forward, this is a special exception, a unique situation that they're trying to draw on. And so are you saying that we should not have criminal negligence homicide? Because isn't that also a unique situation?
No, Chair Brzezinski and members of the committee, what I was just trying to highlight is that this is considered to be an exceptional case. Certainly homicides are an extremely exceptional case, and as a policy matter, this committee has full authority to enact these tools that are on the books. What we see is that there's not a lot of negligent felonies. Criminal negligent homicide is the one I can think of right now. There may be others, but as a practitioner, you rarely see criminal negligent cases anyway. There are some. There's some child neglect cases I've had where negligence is the standard with respect to caring for your child. But on the whole, we just don't see a lot of criminal negligent felonies.
And isn't that what you just said? We should anticipate that you don't see that on a regular basis. There is a unique situation. And based on the testimony we've heard, where you have someone, one, grossly deviating from the standard, two, where it results in significant injury, severed limb, that seems to be one of those very unique situations. And it seems to me that that's a tool that may need to be there or should be there as an option to be used. But all the other standards have to be met. I mean, if it's just simple negligence, someone takes their eyes off the road, distracted by a child, that's negligence. That's not gross deviation. And I think that's the part I'm very concerned with, is how we are using the term without actually clarifying what that really means and the different standards that are required. Any other comments or questions?
Well, I guess I would ask, Mr. Chair, what do you mean by gross deviation?
Well, it's in the, I mean, it's. So this is coming out of the criminal liability ORS 161.085. It gives the definitions, and the definition for criminal negligence is set forth there. It means that a person fails to be aware of a substantial and unjustifiable risk that the result will occur or that the circumstances exist. The risk must be of such nature and degree that the failure to be aware of it constitutes gross deviation from the standard of care that a reasonable person would observe in that situation. So this is, from my perspective, the way I define this, is you have someone who is aware of all this and they say, I'm still going to do what I did. I think the example we had yesterday, with the gentleman who had his leg severed. You had two bicyclists. The person that ran into them, if I remember the testimony correctly, was traveling in the same direction as the two bicyclists, observed one going through the intersection and then cut in between trying to make the turn before the next one came in and ran over the guy. And I would say under those circumstances, that is a gross deviation because you are basically knowing what the risk is and basically following through with your conduct. And so the question would be, if that case is going to be going forward, it's got to go in front of a grand jury. The grand jury has to indict. So that's the first check and balance you have. Actually, it's like the second, because the prosecutors are already doing what they're going to do as to whether they move it forward or not. Then if it is actually true billed, then it has to go in front of a regular jury in a jury trial to make that determination. And then they will be determining, based on the standard here, as whether or not it was a deviation from the standard of care that a reasonable person would observe in that situation.
Well, okay. So in your example, you're saying that the driver purposely didn't, you know, was seeing that there was a second bicyclist and cut him off. Purposely, or are you saying that it just happened that way?
I'm not saying purposely, because I think if you could actually show if the person that was, let's just say, if they had stated and made an admission saying, I purposely did that, we wouldn't be using that example here because they would be taking them up on knowingly or intentionally. Mm-hmm. So that's a different, higher standard for a different type of result. This is where an individual is faced with a situation, a circumstances exist, and under that framework, that they are grossly deviating from the standard that the vast majority of people, a reasonable person, would do.
Okay. I just thought it was interesting. Yesterday it was brought up that the green boxes for bicycles, and I queried a lot of different people yesterday, and they had no clue.
Well, the green box, the green box, in my opinion, based on what we heard yesterday, had absolutely nothing to do with this particular case, except that possibly the argument would be that the green box is on in view of the driver, knowing that this is a place where bicycles go. The green box is basically to move the bikes up at an intersection when the traffic is stopped so they can position themselves in front of the vehicle so you don't have these conflicts of having side by side, because the bike lane is a dedicated lane that's a straight has priority over someone crossing over that lane. So I didn't hear the testimony as that anyone was in the green box to the point of when it started off. But I think what they were saying is that as they went through that intersection, there was a green box there telling people. Now, the reality, whether people know what the rules of the road are and what is in within the manual, that's, you know, I guess what we would say, ignorance is not a defense to any law. And so hopefully individuals become more aware of what are safety devices, precautions, and what those what the rules of the road are as it pertains to that, or just the bike lane. I mean, many people, I feel, do not recognize and understand that that's a dedicated lane for cyclists to be in, and that if you're in a adjacent lane, you have to yield to that lane. You can't just cut across. Any other questions? So I did want to go over one other thing that did come up on this, and this is the, I think, the other part that shows to me that they have taken an approach that is reasonable, is that this is has a sentencing grid chart line of four. So I'm going to pass these out. These come back to Chana. They are her personal copies to use in these examples. And I will just put on there that if you look on there and you look at the category four and draw a line across there, you'll see the first two boxes is 10, 11, and 8, and 9. Those are yellow. Those are the two blocks under a category four that would be presumptive prison time. Everything after that in the C through the I are not presumptive prison but presumptive probation. And so, again, this is not treating it as other, the same level, I believe, would be a level six in the others, if I'm not mistaken. So you can see that there's been some insight and foresight as to making certain that for this particular component of an Assault 3, for vulnerable users of a roadway, that you have a different level of sanction than you do from the others. So, again, I think that this is being surgically applied and trying to take into consideration what many of us are discussing today. All right, so that's where we have on that. So thank you. Unless there's a question for this panel, I'm going to let them go, and then we're going to bring up Jeff Rhodes. Jeff, I need you to be succinct because I got another longer hearing to take up.
Absolutely, Chair Brzezinski. Chair Brzezinski, Vice Chair Cruz, and members of the committee, I am going to be exceedingly brief. I just want to make clear for the committee, we are here in support of the Dash 2 amendments for the bill. These do harken back to 801-608, which is the Vulnerable Road User Statute. I want to make clear that it was always our intention to do that. This was a bill that was aimed at protections for pedestrians, cyclists, folks that we call vulnerable road users. That's all we're aimed at this bill. The last piece that I just want to address very briefly has to do with the deterrence issue. Respectfully, we do disagree with OCDLA on that point. What I would say is that everybody knows that if you're driving a car in a criminally negligent manner and you kill somebody, you're going to be subject to criminal sanctions. I think that's absolutely something that folks know when they're out on the road. They know that they have to have that responsibility. It's tantamount to saying that that has no effect on deterrence to say that this wouldn't also have an effect on deterrence. So we disagree with that point. The other thing that I would say is that this is a bill that's about crime victims' rights. We want to make sure that the crime victims are made whole, that they get their constitutional right to restitution, and that is our main goal here, is protection of crime victims. And with that, I can answer any questions about the bill.
All right, questions for Jeff. Thank you very much. So that concludes the testimony that we had established. That was carried over for 1553. I'm going to go ahead and close the public hearing. This is a bill that we're still waiting for paperwork and stuff, so it will not have a work session today. We are carrying over 1553 until tomorrow, which will have an 8 o'clock start for the committee. With that, we're now going to go ahead and open up a public hearing on Senate Bill 1556. And let's see, is this Whitney?
This is Whitney.
Why don't you give us a quick reminder of that? And Eric, you're the only one that we did not get to in that. So if you'll please come forward to give your testimony when we get the summary.
Thank you, Chair Brzezinski, members of the committee. This is Senate Bill 1556. It was brought to us by Senator Manez Anderson. As was mentioned, we heard a lot of testimony about this bill last week. We do not yet have the fiscal or revenue impact statement. Just briefly, ORS 161.015 currently defines physical injury to either be substantial pain or impairment of the physical condition. This bill would amend that statute that physical trauma would be included within the definition of physical injury to vulnerable victims. There was also a Dash 1 amendment brought to us by Senator Manez Anderson that limited the term vulnerable victim to just dependent persons and then amended related statutes that had physical injury as an element to include intentionally or knowingly causing injury to a vulnerable victim. There is also a Dash 2 amendment that is almost identical to the Dash 1 amendment, except it includes a technical change, and there are no other amendments.
All right, thank you. Eric?
Chair Brzezinski, Vice Chair Cruz, members of the committee, my name is Eric Dietrich. I'm here on behalf of OCDLA. My previous nightmare involved me defending DUI cases when I was asleep, and I would have dreams that I would have to defend an obviously guilty DUI person with an endless stream of witnesses testifying about how intoxicated my client was while I was driving. Now I'm here before this committee testifying in opposition to a second bill directly back to back, and I think this is also something I was not looking forward to, and I'm sure I'll be called again next to testify in opposition to another bill. I hope I'm not. OCDLA does have concerns, and we'd like to put those on the record now with respect to Senate Bill 1556. When we met in late December, beginning of the year, to discuss the upcoming legislative session, we went through the materials that were presented at legislative days in November, and we discussed those. We discussed what the advocate said about why the bill was needed, and we looked at the case law, and we arrived at the conclusion that, as the advocates had said in November, that there was a hole in the law. The presentation focused on cases in which the advocates felt that a victim in certain types of cases, and in November we were talking about domestic violence cases, elder abuse cases, child abuse cases, they felt that they could not obtain convictions in those types of cases unless there was, because they couldn't articulate substantial pain unless that person was in court to describe the pain they experienced. We disagreed with that. We felt as though you can prove any case with circumstantial evidence. We then read the bill when it was introduced. We got together again in January, and we looked at the bill. And when we looked at the bill, we still had concerns, because what we heard in November was a concern about these types of cases in which, because of age, because of capacity, or because of a disability, someone is not able to accurately articulate, or just unable to be present and articulate the pain that they've experienced. That was concern number one. Concern number two was it seemed in opposite to what was discussed in November. In November, you were talking about these specific groups, these specific population groups. The bill is introduced, talked about dependent persons, which is anyone, you know, who's dependent. You know, it's a big population group, those 18 and under, and then it discussed elder abuse, those 65 and older. So we felt that the population group wasn't narrowly tailored to the issue as framed by the advocates. The second piece was the reduction, the terminology used, bruises, cuts, punctures, the terms used, abandoned any sort of a reasonable person scenario that currently exists in the law. So we prepared to come here and talk about this bill and our concerns. And then the Guzman case was issued about two and a half weeks ago. And the Guzman case was a domestic violence case. The defendant was convicted of domestic violence assault. The victim in the case did not testify, and no one testified about the pain the victim in that case, the pain the victim experienced. What happened was the prosecution did what we expect them to do. They put together the evidence that they had. They did as good a job as they could. They used photographs. They used circumstantial evidence. They obtained a conviction, and the Court of Appeals said that was permissible, that these types of cases can be proven through circumstantial evidence. So following that case, I know the bill, there was a proposed amendment to limit it to cases involving just dependent persons. We understand the concerns of the legislators and the advocates bringing this bill. As I mentioned in the testimony I submitted, I tried to get to everyone yesterday, that, you know, we have a lot of frontline attorneys in our office who are probably the only attorneys who are appointed by the court to speak up and advocate for these children. So as an association, we have many members who work for children and are aware of the harm that abuse can cause. We still feel as though the proposed amendment is missing some narrowed tailoring to the specific issue at hand, which is these cases in which someone's not able to articulate the pain. But we're very, the biggest trouble we have is, you know, the shift from these objective standards. When there's an impairment of physical condition, which is the first prong by which the government can prove physical injury.
I need you to wrap up. I've got some comments. We need to be moving forward.
Thank you, Chair Pozanski.
Currently,
there is a role for the court with the objective standard that exists under physical injury and gatekeeping. We are very apprehensive to have those concepts removed and to have any de minimis injury constitute a physical injury that's eligible for a criminal prosecution. Thank you very much. I'm happy to answer any questions.
All right, thank you. Any questions for Eric? Thank you very much. I'm going to go ahead and close the public hearing on 1556. I'm going to go ahead and make statements on this one now so everyone understands where the chair is at. I spent a considerable amount of time in the last two or three days going through this, and a lot of time last night. I've reached the conclusion I do believe that we're trying to rush through a significant change in our statutes that needs to have a work group. And so at this point, this chair is not going to be entertaining moving the bill forward into a work session. Here's the issues I've come away with so everyone kind of understands and put something on the record. This bill was a result of a decision that came out of this Court of Appeals right and it was basically one that we were trying to see maintain a fix. The Guzman case has now come out that seems, from my perspective, allows for the demonstrates that circumstantial evidence without direct testimony from the victim can, in fact, result in convictions in the substantial pain. I also believe that that same theory can be used in improving or proving up impairment of physical condition. And the scenario that I would see is that if you had someone that was providing health care for an individual who was significantly injured, that had a impairment in their physical condition, that individual, that health care provider, that therapist or whoever would be able to come in and testify as to what they observed and how that was, in fact, an impairment, even if the victim themselves, as in the Guzman case, chose not to testify. Accordingly, I don't think that we need to rush through a bill in the short session. This is one of those situations that we had a reason to move it forward. I believe there's been a corrective course by the Court of Appeals with Guzman, and that this will be a work group that will be going on in the interim to see what, if any, changes should be made on the existing statute that dates back to 1971. So with that, we're closing. Say that bill will be not considered for work session this time, and we will be putting it on the Senate Judiciary's list for work group during this coming interim. So with that, we're going to go ahead and open up the public hearing on 1550. And basically, we're picking up where we left off. I have a number of individuals who are here to testify. And Nikki, I'm going to have you come up. Michael, I understand. Michael may have already left. All right. Daryl was not going to be here, so I assume he doesn't need to talk. And why don't we go ahead and have Allison Kelly and Doug Riggs, why don't you two come forward, and then I'm going to take another group after that. And we have 25 minutes. The reason we're pushing really hard is I've been woodshedded by the president's office as to not going beyond 10, even though yesterday we had a consensual agreement. They did not agree with that, and so I need y'all to be very succinct, please, because I have another two panels to bring up.
Thank you, Chair Przanski, members of the committee. Nikki Terzieff here on behalf of the Oregon Coalition Against Domestic and Sexual Violence. We represent the 50-plus nonprofit direct victim services organizations across the state, including on tribal lands. We're committed to providing direct services and direct counsel for domestic violence, sexual assault, and stalking victims. Our programs and their advocates also provide emergency shelter, supplies, safety planning, legal advocacy as well. In the past several years, we've seen this body make a consistent march towards efficient and effective outcomes and accountability within the public safety system, and we believe that 1550 is a great stopgap that the coalition would support to help continue that path. We know that at least 50% of victims of violence do not step forward to report, and this is for many just due to too much distrust in the system at a very critical time. When these survivors decide to take the tough decision to step forward, but they're concerned about the sanctity of pursuing their own justice, it's a huge disruption to those who do and may otherwise seek a systems-based approach. Grand jury recordings, as we've consulted with our sister organizations in other states and have heard no objections, grand jury recordings serve several purposes: transparency, providing the full set of evidence, accountability in closing the gap on lost or misscribed statements, and then expediency, finally, in the plea process. And for us, the less exposure and a less additional traumatization during the process for a survivor, the better. So we know that results can cut both ways, but again, the truth in the case, which is protection for both parties, and as the ability of the protective order is still intact, we're proud to offer support for this bill.
Thank you. And Allison?
May we have Doug go first, please?
Yes.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, for the record, I'm Doug Riggs on behalf of the Oregon Network of Child Abuse Intervention Centers, representing the 21 programs throughout the state that focus on responding to child abuse cases and helping meet the goals of Carley's Law. We were concerned with the initial draft of Senate Bill 1550. The bill as drafted interferes with the principles behind Oregon's evidence-based system of forensic interviews conducted by centers. As a result, we are here today to ask that victims of child abuse and neglect have the same basic protections that the bill affords to victims of domestic abuse. It would be difficult to understand why a 15 or a 16 or a 17-year-old who has suffered from child abuse or neglect would be less worthy of protection than a 14-year-old. My youngest daughter is 16. Some of you may have teenage daughters or granddaughters. They are children not only in our eyes, but also under Oregon law. that are vulnerable, fragile, and fully deserving of the protections from intimidation, fear, or re-traumatization. The amendment that we're suggesting would make a very simple change to the bill. On page 7, line 22, it would add the following words, quote, those under the age of 18 who were victims of child abuse or neglect or witness to domestic abuse. We believe that this is clear, simple, and fair.
Doug, do you know we actually have this amendment ready to go forward?
Mr. Chair, do I know that you have a copy of it?
Now, did you know that we actually have an amendment that's doing exactly what you want? And I want to make certain you knew that, because it sounds like you're trying to impress upon us to actually create an amendment. Mm-hmm. So we're planning, as far as the chair is concerned, to adopt that. So does that assist in your testimony?
Well, my testimony was concluded, so I'm almost done. I haven't seen the Dash 1 amendments, and if something like that is included, I think I'd be very Dash 5s. Then we would be very happy with that. So thank you very much.
Allison.
Good morning, Mr. Chair and members of the committee. I'm Allison Kelly, and I'm the Chief Executive Officer of Liberty House, which is the Child Abuse Assessment Center that serves Marion and one of two that serve Polk County. We are a member of the Oregon Network, and so I am here to testify in concurrence with Doug. With respect to, just to get right to the point, with respect to the amendment that you are seeing that you have in front of you, I would just request whether those three prongs are there. So raising the age from 15 to 18, and we're talking about in the original bill, section 5, sub 13, sub B, which is that same line 22 on page 7. So raising the age from 15 to 18 for the reasons Doug suggested. And it says that if it is a victim of child abuse or neglect or a witness to domestic violence. So if those three things were in there and that age.
It's not.
Okay, so
it's just the age.
Okay, so that's, and I apologize, my letter that I sent on Friday was the age. And so this, my testimony would be to consider if there is time or possibility adding that additional language. My rationale is very short, and that is that this entire discussion is really taking place at an intersection. It's the intersection between the fundamentals of criminal procedure and the best practices surrounding the investigation of child abuse. And those best practices tell us to try to reduce the number of times that children have to describe what they've seen because of the risk of additional trauma. I can tell you that child abuse is so prevalent and the trauma to many of the victims that we see is so extensive that we deeply appreciate your consideration of this amendment, and we'd be happy to answer any questions you may have.
Senator Thatcher.
Has there been an amendment drafted that includes what you're saying?
We are not aware. I don't believe we were able to identify one on OLIS. And again, the letter that I submitted on Friday simply requested the age, but then in further consultation with our colleagues, and I believe Doug has been in consultation with the organization on the other side of this issue, so in an attempt to reach a slightly more confined effect of that amendment, adding that language, a victim of child abuse or neglect or a witness to domestic violence under the age of 18 would put the requested language in a little more narrow construct that would be acceptable. So that's why.
Yeah, go ahead. I've got to come
so
back.
If I understand the amendment correctly, it would be encompassed in that, because any person under the age of 18 for any reason would be covered by that. So I think your purposes are met. That would be, the additional language would further narrow it, but every child under the age of 18 would be covered, correct?
That's correct.
Okay,
and it's to be, my understanding, limited in scenarios of, let's say, person crimes as compared to non-person crimes. Excellent. All right. So hopefully that helps.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, thank you very much. And I would just encourage and invite, I know, all of our centers throughout the state. anybody who'd like to learn more.
And realize that the other part, you said something about domestic violence. There's already hearsay exceptions in the code that allows for an officer to come in as not per se a case agent, but to be giving their testimony in front of a grand jury to report what a victim said to them within the 24 hours, which is covered as hearsay. So all of the hearsay that's on the books today can and will be able to be used in a grand jury proceeding. So in the sense of you will have that there, right, but it doesn't per se keep the individual victim from coming before, because, again, I think this is one of those scenarios that the jury has the right to observe every witness, or should have most, except in these unique cases, such as now a child under 18. Thank you. All right. With that, I've got a panel I'm going to bring up is Dinah Vittles, Bob Herman, Jeff Rhodes. And, folks, we have 17 minutes, and I've got two other people to bring up, so I'm going to limit you all to 12 minutes, knowing that you've already have participated in some levels of giving either testimony or in the work group.
Chair Przanski, members of the committee, my name is Dinah Vittles. I am the Crook County District Attorney and President of the Oregon District Attorneys Association. The Oregon District Attorneys Association, as well as 35 of the 36 district attorneys in Oregon, oppose Senate Bill 1550 as it is currently drafted. We appreciated the opportunity to work with the chair of the committee and the criminal defense bar over the interim, and were hopeful we would be able to find a solution that we could support. The district attorneys are not opposed to the policy of recording grand jury, but any bill must contain unqualified protections for victims and witnesses and must be adequately funded at all levels of government. The grand jury process is not abused in Oregon. Prosecutors take their role and the role of the grand jury very seriously. Assertions that the process is abused are unfounded, unjustified, and do not in any way advance the policy discussions. Oregon prosecutors do not purposely manipulate evidence in order to obtain grand jury indictments. In the one instance we are aware of over the last 30 years, the district attorney was both prosecuted and disbarred. Nevertheless, we acknowledge that 39 states record grand jury proceedings. However, as you'll hear from Mr. Rhodes, our extensive review of state practices also found that 44 states allow police officers to testify on behalf of witnesses and victims, or don't apply the rules of evidence altogether. Why? To protect victims and save money. The ODAA believes that this widely accepted standard can and must be adopted in Oregon should we begin recording grand jury proceedings. Senate Bill 1550, however, does not adopt this national standard. Rather, this bill creates a court-driven process that forces the DA, victim, or witness to seek a protective order from the court. This process requires time and money from the district attorney and will force victims and witnesses to seek outside counsel to protect their interests. Moreover, it simply will not offer adequate protection. Within the last year, there was a case in Crook County where a juvenile was charged with several acts of graffiti. A responsible high school student reported his conduct to the police. The juvenile learned who reported him from, in this case, the police reports, and told his mother and sister. They then sought out the witness and beat her up. While we might expect this type of behavior in a violent person crime, this was a simple property offense. It is absolutely impossible to predict which cases will lead defendants to violence. In a case like this, it is almost certain the prosecutor would never seek a protective order, and even less likely a judge would have found the facts to meet the substantial and compelling standard that is required by Senate Bill 1550. There is no history of violence to demonstrate that the witness was in danger. The fact is, recording grand jury without allowing police officer hearsay testimony will sooner rather than later lead to violent victimization. Beyond the risk of witness intimidation and victim retribution, it is nearly certain that recordation will have a chilling effect on victim testimony. As victims and witnesses, you've heard that victims and witnesses will not be affected by the recording and release of grand jury testimony. That defies logic. We work with these witnesses every day, and I can assure you it is a traumatic, life-altering experience for victims, especially those who have already endured unspeakable violence. Recordation and release to the defendants will have a further chilling effect on witness and especially victim participation. Senate Bill 1550 represents an extraordinary change in the practice of criminal law in Oregon. It touches every component of the system, law enforcement officers, prosecutors, defense attorneys, the circuit courts, the appellate courts, victims, witnesses, and our citizen grand jurors. It is not just a matter of pressing a record button and handing off a CD. It is arguably appropriate for Oregon to begin recording grand jury, but the process proposed in Senate Bill 1550 neither matches the national standard nor meets the high standards Oregonians should demand. There are other and, we believe, better ways to do this. In that spirit, ODAA offered a different approach during the workgroup meeting. Our proposal includes recording all grand juries, but asks the defense bar to request the recording in a wide range of situations, such as when witnesses' grand jury testimony is different from the statement in the police report, or when the indictment differs from the police report, or when the witnesses in the grand jury are divergent from those that appear on law enforcement documents. The proposal also includes police officer hearsay, the national standard to protect victims and witnesses. Finally, it assures the defense and public that the process is fair without jeopardizing witnesses or opening the floodgates of litigation. And those are the -4 amendments that we have proposed. Finally, we recognize that there will be time to discuss the cost of Senate Bill 1550 when it goes to Ways and Means. We would be remiss not to briefly mention that implementing grand jury recordation is expensive, both one-time costs and ongoing expenses. We look forward to exploring how to ensure any recording proposal is adequately funded. Chair and committee members, thank you for your time and attention. This is a critical issue and will have a dramatic effect on the criminal justice process in Oregon. I reiterate that the ODAA is absolutely prepared to record grand jury proceedings, but we want to do it in the safest, most cost-effective, fair, and responsible method possible. Thank you.
Got 5.5 minutes.
Chair Brzezinski, members of the committee, I'll try to be respectful of your time. I do have a presentation here, but it's only 3 slides, so I'll be very brief with it. My name is Jeff Rhodes. I'm the legislative liaison for the Multnomah County District Attorney's Office. I'm here today on behalf of the Multnomah County District Attorney's Office and the Oregon District Attorneys Association. And I think you're having some of our slides handed out there as well. I'm here today just to cover a few technical aspects of this very dense bill. In researching grand jury statutes and practices around the country, one thing did become clear, and we do agree with OCDLA on this point. There are so many different approaches. There's almost as many different approaches as there are states in our union. So it is very difficult to make a comparison. With that in mind, we do have a few slides here. And the first slide we've put together here is on the indictment process in Oregon. In speaking with some of the membership, it became clear that this is a little bit mysterious. So we thought it would be a good idea to hand out some slides just to make sure that the committee understands exactly how a case gets to grand jury, gets to the indictment process, and ultimately the goal is to get onto the trial docket, as you can see there. And what you see is that a lot of things occur in the criminal justice system, a lot of checks and balances, even before the judiciary does get involved in the case. You have your crime that occurs, but what you can see is it's dependent upon first if a victim reports. When the police investigate, whether or not an arrest is made, we'll have a determination as to whether or not a case may or may not be referred or go to grand jury. If the case is referred to the DA, however, there is yet another check and balance there. That's a point where the district attorney will review all the police reports and determine whether or not there is enough evidence to go forward. Again, this all happens before the judge is involved in the case. Only at that point would a judge be involved if the DA files charges and then is therefore arraigned on those charges on an information. At that point, it is a determination whether or not the case is a felony or misdemeanor. We'll let you know whether or not you get to grand jury or not. If that case is a felony, as you can see, it gets to the grand jury process, and then only if the grand jury does find that there's enough evidence, it will get on the trial docket at that point. I want to stress at that point we're on the trial docket. That doesn't mean that the defendant has been convicted of a crime, very far from it. That is when we get to the point that the courts are involved, we have motions, we've got potential trial, we have all sorts of negotiation. So all we're talking about in the grand jury process is getting to the trial docket. We're not talking about convicting somebody. This is very on the front end of the case. And I know I'm flying through these. I apologize. I'm happy to check in with folks offline, too, about this. So what we saw when we looked through all 50 states, you've heard from the proponents of this bill that Oregon is in the minority of states that do not record grand jury. That is the case. However, what you can also see is that's not the full story. And what we did for this is we looked at the western states, our close neighbors, thinking that that would be probably the most useful information to the committee. And what we found was that the majority of these cases, these states, do not actually actively use the grand jury process. So in order to fully understand how Senate Bill 1550 will affect the criminal justice system in Oregon, you do have to examine which of the states actively use the grand jury process in the manner that Oregon does. The answer is there are not many of our close neighbors. In fact, as you see, California, Nevada, Idaho, Washington, Montana, Utah, these states, they all are primarily preliminary hearing states. And that is something that is important in your deliberations.
Jeff, I'm not sure how much time you're leaving for Bob, but it's getting very close.
Okay. Well, I will, in the essence of time, I can chat with folks offline about this. But what I do want to say really quickly, there are a few technical pieces of the bills I'd like to, and the amendments I'd like to draw the committee's attention to. Section 7 of the bill and the Dash 1 amendments in particular, they contain some language that states that whatever charges are related to the criminal charge should appear in the indictment. There is a concern that that would be a very broad brush that we'd be using there, and we could even capture conduct from different counties, even from different states, and we want to make certain that that provision is narrowly tailored. I think the intention of the drafters was to make certain that every single grand jury date that appeared on a single case number would be on the indictment so that the defense attorney could make certain they had the recordings of each one of those grand jury dates. I think that provision is a little bit broader than that right now and would potentially capture other cases, which I don't think was the intention of the drafters. I'm also concerned about the wording of the in the Dash 1 amendments. When we look at the rules of evidence portions of it, there is a portion there that states that references 40.460 and says that anything that would apply under that provision should come into the grand jury. Of course, the rules of evidence already apply to grand jury in the state of Oregon, and I'm worried that this provision may leave out certain types of non-hearsay, other types of admissible evidence that we do present to the grand jury that are admissible. And so I want to make certain that that provision's not capturing things that it's not as well. And just finally, the protective order provisions in the Dash 1 amendments as well. I would like to hammer out some better timelines there. As it is now, I'm concerned that the timelines aren't workable and we won't actually be able to get these protective orders. In talking with the Oregon Judicial Department and the showings that are going to be required for these, substantial and compelling circumstances, a high bar. So hopefully we can take a look at whether or not we can adjust timelines or change some language there. And with that, and if there are any questions, I'm happy to answer them.
Bob, you have maybe 2 minutes because they're already 2 minutes over. I've got another witness, and we were planning on working the bill today, but I don't know if we will.
Thank you, Chair Przanski, Vice Chair Cruz, members of the committee. I'm Bob Herman, District Attorney from Washington County, and I would, I guess, summarize my comments in two ways. One, tremendous expense and tremendous volume of workload placed upon the court through litigation. That's going to involve hiring of clerks. It's going to involve judge time. It's going to involve a lot of attorney time, and I think that needs to be explored very seriously before the Ways and Means Committee. Additionally, I guess the other summary I would say is victims and witnesses and best practices. As the chart indicates, the best practice is to record grand juries around the country. You can't have it both ways. The best practice in 45 states is to allow hearsay testimony by agents, police officer agents, and it's to allow the lack of the evidence rules. The grand jury proceeding is not a trial. The victim will go through a trial. There will be the potential for a trial. The grand jury proceeding is a review by citizens of the evidence to determine whether there's sufficient evidence to move forward.
You've heard from a number of victims' representatives. As I was sitting here, I was thinking, who's here for the elders? 10,000 of us will turn 65 each day in this country, and elder abuse is on the rise and will continue to be a focus of our concerns. Who's here to speak for them? So finally, I just say that you've heard the other day from a panel of victim advocates who represent all victims. Aaron Olson, attorney. You heard from Rosemary Brewer, the Oregon Crime Victims Law Center director, and Steve Dole of Crime Victims United. They represent all victims, and their message is clear. Why deviate from a nationwide best practice of allowing hearsay testimony at the grand jury? Thank you.
Thanks. No questions here. I'll save my comments till later. I've got two other witnesses that are scheduled to testify. That would be Walter Todd and Dave Factor. We will take their testimony, and then we will conclude for the day. Once we get through the formalities, why don't you give me your name and let's do the testimony, because I've got the president's office sitting in here ready to woodshed me, but we're going to take your testimony.
Chairman, members of the committee, thank you. My name's Walter Todd. I'm a criminal defense attorney for 34 years in Salem. I've done nothing but criminal defense for the last 30 years or so. I was also a prosecutor for the first 2 years. I have had experience in presenting cases to the grand jury when I was a prosecutor. I've testified at a grand jury, interestingly enough, as a witness. I have decided to waive jury many times. I've been in the hallway a lot of times when my clients went in without me in front of a grand jury, but mostly, of course, having done hundreds and hundreds of felony defense cases, I've just experienced the indictment from a secret grand jury process. I'm here to testify both individually and on behalf of the OCDLA in favor of recording and tell a case story that kind of illustrates why we need recording and why the notes system is not working. I had a case where an individual was charged with ballot measure 11 crimes, two counts, so 75 months each. He entered a not guilty plea. He told me he was innocent, and even though this is not relevant to this part of the story, I believed he was innocent. The police officer had already taken a statement from the complainant. The complainant also talked to DHS and gave a statement, and then the complainant testified at the grand jury. There were seven people on the grand jury. Only six of them took notes, and I'll discuss the actual notes in a minute. But so my client enters a not guilty plea. He's faced with the potential of 13 and a half years in prison. He's got no priors. We asked for the grand jury notes. The state says, no, we're not going to give you that unless you can meet some threshold level of proof that somehow they might be inconsistent with statements that were made. So I got the police report and I got the DHS report. And there were some inconsistencies, and the state still refused. I had to file a motion to try to get the court to review the grand jury notes in chambers. This is a common experience. The state objects. They file the motion about the need of the privacy of the grand jury. At some point, the judge disclosed, she orders the state to bring those notes to her chambers. She reviews them. She sees a major inconsistency between the police reports and the DHS and what was said at the grand jury. So she orders that the notes be disclosed. The notes, as you might expect, written by seven different people. Only six people actually wrote notes. The sixth person actually only wrote one sentence. So five of the people, they're not professional stenographers. The notes were very cryptic and hard to read, and you couldn't actually see, except for perhaps on one of them, the four person, what the major inconsistency was. So it became necessary to subpoena the grand jurors to a hearing at the trial in order to try to figure out what the notes meant. The case had already been going on for 10 or 11 months. The judge subpoenaed.
Walter, I think we get the picture as to the difficulty and why we want something recorded versus relying on handwritten notes. I need you to summarize in 30 seconds so I can get the other testimony in and I can conclude the day so the president can be happy.
Okay.
That won't make him happy, but he'd be less mad.
Suffice to say that the inconsistent statements were huge, and the court, well, it was a court trial, and the court found that those grand jury inconsistencies, once you put the grand jurors on the witness stand, they could not even look at their own notes a year later now, of course, and tell us what they meant. So In terms of the actual response to the state's argument about hearsay, the OCDLA position is that if this legislative body were to accept the DA's view that you should convert over to hearsay, then Oregon should continue to rely on the handwritten notes over that system, no matter how disastrous the handwritten notes system is. It's more important to have live testimony. I've been in hearings where hearsay is allowed, DMV suspension hearings, for example. Now you're taking more power away from that body, the grand jury. You should be giving more power to the grand jury to see face-to-face testimony. The charts that the state has, that we haven't had a chance to talk about specifics, but it's inaccurate because there are certain states that use nothing but prelims. And in terms of the state's worrying about trauma, re-victimization, trauma to witnesses, if it's not in the police reports already, or, for example, if it doesn't happen at preliminary hearings, grand jury testimony does not cause re-victimization of witnesses. The police reports already have that information. The defense already has that information. It's a Brady versus Maryland requirement that it be turned over anyway. So,
all right.
Thank you. That's all I have.
Thank you very much. Dave?
Thank you, Chair Pozanski, Vice Chair Cruz, members of the committee. For the record, my name is David Factor, staff counsel with the Oregon Judicial Department. I will be brief. I'll turn in written testimony later so it's be in the record. Let me just say that under current law, the court's role with grand jury is very limited. We summons the grand jury. We typically, as part of a larger jury pool, we select the seven grand jurors, swear them in, and then they accompany the district attorney to review the presentation of those cases. And in most all instances, that's the end of the court's involvement, other than when their jury duty is complete, we do the payroll and pay them for their service. Senate Bill 1550 creates a new role for the courts that require development of a new program and significant investment in staff to implement. The operative dates of the bill are also an issue for us, since they all occur in the next biennium. It creates a real concern about the connection between the passage of the policy bill by this legislative assembly and funding by a future legislative assembly. The Chief Justice has been consistent in his message related to this measure. The OJD is neutral on the policy of recording grand jury proceedings. However, we don't believe that the adoption of this policy requires the court's role as grand juries to be expanded to include the recording and management of the records of grand jury proceedings. The preference of the OJD would be that if grand jury proceedings are to be recorded, it can be the obligation of the district attorney. The district attorney is in attendance in the grand jury room already. They can monitor the recording process. They can maintain the recordings for later distribution consistent with any protective orders, and they can prepare their motions for protective orders as they already have access to the recordings. This procedure is analogous to discovery in criminal cases. The courts don't manage today the day-to-day routine obligations of the parties in discovery. We only become involved when the party does not comply with their obligation to referee disputes or to set timelines for production when necessary. We don't become a repository for all things that may later be subject to discovery requests. We don't have or hold police reports, for example. That same reasoning could be applied here. Courts would only be involved when there is a dispute about providing a copy of the recording to a party, making decisions concerning protective orders, or whether to make a recording available to someone other than a party upon request. Grand jury proceedings today occur outside the presence of the court and are managed by the district attorneys. Grand juries are convened in approximately 50 locations in the 36 counties. Most locations are in courthouses, but not in parts of the buildings controlled by the court. They are in offices of the district attorney or offices of the county, and sometimes in off-site locations, child advocacy centers or assessments locations, for example, where there are no court staff. We would have to arrange access agreements with district attorneys and coordinate grand jury proceedings to ensure court staff could be present every time the grand jury meets.
I mean,
we offered amendments to clarify procedural elements of the bill and to give the Chief Justice.
Dave, I need you to put it in writing. A lot of the stuff you're giving us right now, you know, is already in the bill. And so just if you have other things you want to say, put it in writing and get it to us. It doesn't seem I try to give you an opportunity to get some stuff on the record, but you're already talking about stuff that's already included in the bill, and it's like it's not in there, and I'm not sure why we're having this discussion. So So thank you very much. If you want to conclude whatever you have and put it in writing, this committee is more than willing to have it, but I would suggest that you have it to us before the end of the day.
Thank you, Chair Pozanski. I will submit written testimony before the end of the day. I will respectfully say that not all those things that I was talking about are included in the bill.
And some of that stuff, as you know, will be worked out in ways and means. So with that, I appreciate everyone coming forward. I'm going to go ahead and adjourn the committee. So, Mr. President, I will. And so before we do that, we will be carrying over all of the bills that we had on today's agenda, with the exception of 1556. So 1553, 1571, 1555, and 1550 are carried over until tomorrow at 8 a.m. Thank you.